Hello and welcome back to Matt's Truck and Grep podcast. Matt Ireland hosting once again. Today I'm joined by a very special guest, former motorcycle rider and truck racer, Steve Parrish. Steve, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you very much indeed. No, all good. Had a busy day playing golf today. A lot of people would think, what am I doing playing golf? But it gives me some exercise. And I take my dog, which is a Springer Spaniel, and it's tied to my trolley and pulls me around. So
marvellous. Oh.
so that helps a great deal. So that's me getting less exercise and the dog getting more. But anyway.
Well, being a Springer, it's going to need a fair bit of exercise, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Somewhat lively, I think it's fair to say.
I think they say a Springer's born half, no, a Labrador's born half trained and a Springer dies half trained. And that's about it, I think, something like that. All good. Thank you very much indeed.
Excellent.
Looking forward to the summer. It's going to be a busy one.
Yes, indeed for me as well. So as soon as it warms up a bit as well, because as I was saying to you off air, I've had to be on my bike this week to commute to work because the clutch had gone on my van. And the first vehicle I saw this morning was a Gritter going the other way. And the ride's about half an hour, and at 4:30 in the morning, it was just not enjoyable. You're meant to enjoy riding a bike, and my hands were awful by the time I got to work. I think it's fair.
Yeah, well, I'm like you. I'm a bit of a sort of blue sky summer rider, but I do have hand grips, warmers, and heated jackets and things like that. But generally, I just go out when it's above 18 degrees and the sun is shining. That's
me. I don't blame you. I have got heated grips, but they don't work, unfortunately. So
another little job.
Another little job to add to the list. So there we go. So, Steve, how I'm presuming that you started off like a lot of people riding bikes at a very young age, you know, long before it was legal, so to speak.
Yeah, not very well. I say very young. I mean, nowadays, if you're not won some championship by the time you're 8 years old, you're too old. But I probably started about maybe 11, 12. It was that time. It's where basically I had to save up £5 through washing people's cars or doing chores to be able to go and buy an old BSA or a James or anything that had an engine that I could get running. Yeah. So, yeah, 12, 13 years old, something like that. And was a bit of a hooligan, tearing around the fields. And luckily, I was born in a small village called Steepen Warden, and it had a disused airfield.
Yeah.
So that was where I used to go and scare myself and everyone else around that ever got on the back of me or anything else like that.
I can imagine.
In fairness, it didn't just have to be a motorbike. It could be a car, it could be anything. And I was with a friend the other day, and some of the vehicles we had Austin 7s, Austin 16s, Triumph Mayflowers, J2, Austin vans, anything that was a scrapper that would run. We used to drive around the fields and on the wherever we could. There was an old Roman road that we'd tear along and things like that. So anything that was £5 or less was my mode of transport. And then, of course, at 16, you were allowed to go on the road. I think I went on the road way before that. In fact, the local bobby caught me one day when I was about 14. But anyway, I went to Hallands of Cambridge and bought a 250 Yamaha, which I'm pleased to say I've still got it. Not that I kept it all the way through, but I bought it back off of someone that knew it was mine, and it's in my collection along with some of my race bikes. And yeah, that sort of gave me mobility, I guess you could say.
Yeah. So did you I can't remember what the stipulation for having a test at that sort of time was. Was it 16?
You could go on the road at 16 with a bike. I used to actually go to the youth club on a tractor, though, because you could do that at 15. So I used to be able to, my dad was a bit of a farmer, and I used to go to the youth club on a Nuffield when I was 15 because we were allowed. But 16, but you could put in for your test before your birthday. So I think 16 years and 2 weeks, I passed my test, which back then was driving down the road with a bloke stood on the side of the road with a clipboard and watched you ride away and stepped out in front of you to give you an emergency stop.
Yeah.
Which he didn't do for me because I got lost and came at him from behind. He was looking down the road and I came from behind him. But anyway, I passed my test, got involved with a load of bikers from around this area. I guess I was one of your rockers, really. There was mods and rockers back then. This is 68, 69, something like that.
Yeah.
And would wear my leather jacket, or it was probably plastic because I couldn't afford a proper leather one. But got to know a bunch of guys, again, locally, that decided it'd be good fun to have a race team because we used to go to the pub. We didn't like darts. We didn't like snooker. We didn't play football. We liked engines. So it was decided we'd have a race team. And there was a guy that could weld. There was a guy that did paint work. There was a guy that did electronics. And there was everybody there. At the time, I was doing an apprenticeship as a tractor mechanic. But generally, I used to beat them on the road. So they said, you better be the rider. And that's really
Right.
how it started. There was nobody in my family that was ever into it. So it was just a sort of fluky thing that came out of a bunch of lads getting together and
Having a good time.
talking about it down the pub and going racing. And we really went racing just to mix in with a community of like-minded people. Snetterton was the local track for me. But I'd head off if the van that we had, which I think we had all sorts of old shit vans that would break down and whatever. You never knew if I can remember on numerous occasions we'd have the motorbike petrol tank on top of the engine inside the cab because it was like an Austin J4 or something, and it would have to be gravity fed because the fuel pump had gone and all that. But that was all part of the fun of it, really. That
Yeah,
was
because
where that was really, I think, amateur racing is where people have more fun. Once it gets professional, it gets a bit serious.
yeah, absolutely. And it's just a good crack, isn't it? You know, it's similar to going to a show or something like that with a bunch of friends, all like-minded, just there for that one reason, you know. And like you say, before you get serious sponsorship and the pressure that you have to win as such to satisfy these sponsors, I can see why it's a lot more fun at a sort of amateurish level.
I mean, you strive to get better and better and better, but sometimes you fall into that commercialized trap that you, as you rightly say, you've got people. And even one of my first sponsors was a chicken farmer from Oxfordshire, and you felt more obliged to make sure you turned up on time and you got all the bikes prepared and you didn't get pissed the night before or the over the weekend and all those sort of things. So gradually, bit by bit, it starts to become more like a job, I guess you could say, less like a bunch of fun. That doesn't really slot in until you really are properly sponsored by a factory team or something like that. But I have to feel sorry for, I mean, the guys that are doing it now, when you get into Grand Prix, they're earning millions and millions of pounds, but they're not really enjoying it because the pressure that they're under and the workload that they have, because when they finish one race on a Sunday, they might have Monday off, and then it's in the gym, and then it's seeing the dietitian, then you go and see the psychiatrist, and then you sit with the data guy. So it's pretty much 24/7, really, that they're living in. And that was sort of, it wasn't quite as serious in my days, but there's no question about it. When you've got millions or hundreds of thousands of pounds being spent on you by proper sponsorship companies, whether it be oil companies, tyre companies, manufacturers, you are then obliged to not be seen doing things that didn't seem the right thing to do, like going out night clubbing and getting drunk and doing all the things that are bad publicity for the manufacturers that you're involved with.
Seeming unprofessional, I
Yeah,
guess.
very. Yeah, and I think that's sometimes quite difficult. That's why, arguably, at times in normal life, it's quite nice to be self-employed because you feel that you're putting the pressure on yourself as opposed to your boss looking down on you.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And it gives you more of a drive to actually go to work and get a job done rather than just think, oh, the weather's nice today. I can't be bothered. I'm going to sit at home, you know, and I'm still going to get paid for that. Because my boss is going to pay me regardless, whereas if you're self-employed, that
And
can't
I think
happen.
I'm sounding a bit like politics here, but I think that's half the problem we have in this country. There's a lot of people out there that really just all they're interested in is having, well, maybe finish on Friday, dreading going to work on Monday if they can take a day or two off. We've become maybe a bit of a lazy society now. That's why I love people that have start small businesses and self-employed and entrepreneurial, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Driven people.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, definitely. So wait, can you remember when you sort of transitioned to from sort of amateur to an actual professional racer as such?
Yeah, pretty much. By 1976, I got a really nice sponsor. Harold Coppock was my first sponsor, who was a chicken farmer. And then a guy who was a builder from Guildford, a guy called Dave Moore. He bought me a TZ750 Yamaha and a RG500. Same thing. I've got that very bike in my collection here, which will be going out this year. It'll be at all the Goodwood events. Because it's a big celebration this year of 50 years of Barry Sheen winning his first world championship in 1976.
Brilliant.
I went on to win the British Championship that year in 1976. But yeah, very much obliged to do things properly because Dave Moore wasn't a hugely wealthy guy, but he put every penny he had. His wife used to hate me because she wanted a new kitchen and I kept falling off his bike, and so he never got a new kitchen. But we're friends now. But I've actually got the very same bike in my collection now, and it will be going out at Goodwood this year. So that to me was a point where I'd virtually stopped working as an apprenticeship, doing my apprenticeship, because my commitment was so big. But my full professional career started in 77 when I signed for Suzuki's. I had the call, did I want to join Barry Sheen doing the World Championships, which is like, that's a pinnacle. Whether it really not winning races, it's having that chance to make your hobby into a full-on professional and earn money from doing it. Because up until 77, I probably hadn't earned any money. I'd won some prize monies and trophies and odds and ends, but not really making a full living out of it. And so 77 was the year I turned fully professional. Jacked in all my work. I even had my own little business repairing cars and odds and ends, and that all had to go, really. So,
So
all
just,
of a sudden I was a professional sports person, I guess you'd say.
yeah, absolutely. And it's just at that point, it's just like, well, there's no turning back now. I'm fully committed. I'm going for it, and I've got to give it my all. And to then be paired up with someone like Barry Sheen, that must have been quite something as well.
Yeah, I mean, he was the poster. He was a poster on my wall. There would be Barry Sheen, Phil Reed, Giacomo Agostini, you name it, all the superstars that were winning races when I was coming through the amateur ranks. Because Barry was 3 years older than me and started 3 years earlier than me because his father got him into it when he was about 15 or 16. By now, I'm 21, I think, something like that. And yeah, to actually go out on the track with him and travel around with him was rather special. And weird as hell was, I'll never forget the first time I overtook Giacomo Agostini, 15 times world champion. I couldn't believe, that was it. I'm looking at him and he's looking at me, thinking, who the bloody hell is that? And that's my hero, Ago. So, yeah, so they're the things that give you the great pleasures of being into a sport at a fairly high level and achieving things that you would never have dreamed of 5 or 6 years before.
Absolutely. It must
Um,
have
but
been
the, the downside,
amazing.
the downside, of course, was the fact that when you crashed, a lot of people died. And through that era of 77 through to probably when I stopped in 86, I think I lost about 20 odd mates really that died because it was hugely dangerous. The bikes were quite fast. The protective clothing that we wore was pretty rubbish. It was the best in the day, but it hadn't got much padding in it. Certainly didn't have airbags. We didn't have back protectors. We didn't have boots that stop you breaking your ankles, and the gloves were like golf gloves. So you ended up covered. If you didn't die, you ended up with huge scars all over you and broken legs and arms and everything else. So a lot of injuries around that time. But I think that probably made it more exciting because it was a bit, scary to do, but gave you a huge amount of adrenaline.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of I know road racing is different, but a lot of the TT races sort of it's obviously the same with road as track racing. It's a potential issue as such. You know the risk, the inherent risk of doing the sport, and it's if you are sadly killed doing it, you're at least doing something that you love. And I think, I'm not a racer at all, and but I think it's the racer mentality, knowing obviously they're your mate, but and you've lost them, and that is absolutely tragic. But you know in your head that they did it doing what they love, and it wasn't just something boring and mundane as such. As I know it's not the best way of putting it, but you see where I'm
No,
coming
I
from.
think that's right. You know what you're about to do. You understand the risks. You see what's going on, and you have to accept that. I can't think it's much fun. But I think for me, I was probably more scared of ending up in a wheelchair than I was dying. I think just because you knew you'd probably end up with enduring a life that wasn't really any, you couldn't do anything that you really wanted to do. And lots of people did that as well, unfortunately. That was the way it was. But I think sometimes you're a bit lucky. Sometimes you're maybe slightly more cautious. I've often said I don't think I ever properly raced at 100%. I was a bit of a 95% guy that got me to a reasonable level, but I kind of did err on the side of caution a little bit. That sounds ridiculous when I used to do the TT and finish third and got on the podium a few times, but even so, I didn't feel that I could give it what maybe Joey Dunlop did or people like that that were proper TT riders. I had a fair amount of a bit in reserve, put it that way.
I've got you. Self-preservation, perhaps, and it's at the end of the day, you're still here, aren't you? That's a and
I am, and there is, as I rightly say, I look at pictures now from the 80s, and half the people that are in it, if there's 10 people in it, five of them aren't here anymore, and that's sort of a bit how it was. But there you go, very fortunate guy. Never thought I'd live this long, actually, quite frankly. I'm quite shocked. I thought A, it would take longer to get this old, and B, I never thought I'd get this old. So anyway, maybe I'm a lucky guy.
Yeah, I'd say so. So what was it like being with Barry Sheen a lot then? You sort of got up to a few hijinks, I presume.
It was wild and exciting and dangerous and fun and just hanging out with all these sort of superhero people that I used to go off to different parties and meet different people. And in 1978, I was sponsored by George Harrison from the Beatles and used to go in his house and things like that. And you
Wow.
just can't believe all these lovely things are happening to you. We travel the world getting paid to do it, staying in nice hotels and doing great things. And yeah, it was absolutely brilliant. But all the time in the back of your mind, going, oh, bloody hell, we lost poor old Jerry Dunlop when, and people from that era, Dave Potter, who was a good mate of me and mine, and Tom Heron, who was my teammate, Pat Heron. And it just sort of all the time, in some ways, you went, oh, bloody hell, that if the percentages are about right, I might be all right here. And I think it was a bit of a war zone. And I guess the same would have been. And I'm wrong in actually aligning it with it. But when you took off in your Spitfire in the war, you knew that, about one in four didn't come back. And that was a bit that way in racing, I guess, to a certain extent. And I'm pleased to say that things have got considerably better. More the fact that they've made the circuit safe, and that was the problem that we had, not just our protective clothing. It was the fact that there was barriers all around, and that was the problem. A bit like the TT. We say the TT was dangerous, but I can remember racing at Brands Hatch, which was lined with railway sleepers, and Oulton Park would be the same. And if it wasn't railway sleepers, it was Armco barriers, because all those circuits were really majoring on car racing, and they didn't worry about bike racing quite as much. But anyway, it was a wonderful, wonderful time. Wouldn't change it for the world. I've got dodgy knees because I broke them, and I've got dodgy hips, and I've got dodgy ankles, and all sorts of pins and scar and things put in me. Most of them have been taken out now. And I do at times think, bloody hell, if I hadn't crashed at Aston and snapped all my ACLs and things, I'd be able to walk a bit better and stuff like that. But really, I wouldn't have changed it for the world. Had a wonderful, wonderful time. And here I still talk about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you retired from motorbike racing, and then you got a little bit into the car side of things. Is that right?
A bit, but mainly what happened straight after I finished racing myself, and I've got a picture up here, 1986 was my last ever race in Macau near Hong Kong. Hung up the leathers, but I already had a team set up to run from 87. So I had good sponsorship from Yamaha and Loctite, the adhesive company. So from 87, the 87 season, 87, 88, 89, 90, 91, 5 years, I ran my own team from my workshops and had two riders in the team for those 5 years. Won three, four British championships. I had Rob McElhinney, Terry Reimer, Mark Phillips, Trevor Nation, Keith Hewan, all riders that rode for me. And we won three, I can't remember, three or four British championships. Won some world championship races with Terry Reimer and Rob McElhinney. And it was great. I enjoyed it. Not as much as riding myself, but quite clearly, when you win, it's the rider that's the one that's going around with a laurel around his neck and waving to everyone, and the team manager's packing everything up as such. And when you lose, the riders blame the team manager and everything else. So it was okay. But I came to an ultimatum in the start of, well, the end of 1991. I had a proposal given to me by Mercedes-Benz to go full-time truck racing. And I'd been doing some truck racing running the team, which sometimes made it a bit awkward because I might miss one or two races and I'd have to get someone else to take over my job as team principal because I'd be away racing trucks. At that point, just supported by Mercedes UK and a team called Atkins Racing. But anyway, at the end of 91, Mercedes invited me to join the factory team. And it was a real kind of awkward time because the team was going extremely well. I was earning a good living out of it and everything was running nicely. But by then I was 32 years old and I worked out that I could run a team till I'm 60 or 70, but I couldn't go racing at that time. So I thought, sod it, I'll have a go at carrying on racing because I did miss it a bit. And literally went over to Germany, tested the factory team trucks. Was faster than all the drivers. They'd got three drivers at the time, two German, one Hungarian driver. And I was faster than all those guys, signed on the dotted line. And that was it, truck racing for 10 years, 91 to 2001. Yeah.
So you were saying you'd sort of been dipping your toe in a little bit to begin with, previous to 91. How did you end up getting in? Because I think the first sort of truck racing you did was about 86, I think it was, which is only sort of two years after it actually started. The first British one was in 84. I mean, being in the world of race and whatnot, was this kind of like a new sport that was just sort of appearing and hearing about, or did you just go and watch it out of curiosity, or?
Well, no, it was all down to bloody Barry Sheen again. Everything I did was down to Barry Sheen, because at the end of Barry Sheen's career, which was 84, I think, to 80, yeah, 84, he had sponsorship from DAF Trucks. It was on the back of
Yes.
his bikes. And so when truck racing turned up in the UK, and you might be right, I did the first race, I think, in the UK, which was the Donington Multipart Truck Grand Prix.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if that was 84 or 85. Driving, funny enough, a truck in the colours from down your way, a company called Mitchell Cotts,
Yes.
who were a truck transport company down Norwich, Ipswich way, I think, somewhere down there.
This episode of Matt's Truck and Grep podcast is proudly brought to you by MSL European. MSL European transport cars on covered car transporters or open transport. They can also handle static caravans and also machinery, covering all of the UK, Europe and beyond. Thank you very much, MSL, for your kind support. I'm not too, I can't remember, to be honest, because I thought that they were a truck franchise dealership, but I could be very wrong. But yeah, they were white and blue
They
livery, if
might.
I remember.
All I remember, they were blue and white diamond shapes.
Yes.
I've got a picture somewhere of it.
Yeah.
And that was my first ever truck, and it was a road truck, and that's what truck racing was then. They
Yeah.
hadn't modified at all. And I'm going to guess it was a 1644, something like that,
I think so, yeah, something like
a 16, and it was a road truck. They hadn't modified it at all, apart from I got the fuel injection company to wind up the pump so it had more power. And it was a ludicrous race. There was biggest crowd they ever had at Donington Park. It went
Wow.
berserk.
Yeah.
M1 was shut because of traffic jams and everything else. And nobody's brakes lasted more than three laps. So everyone was out going off the track and everything else. The truck brakes are not designed to stop trucks going flat out to nothing and flat out to nothing.
Yeah.
And so everyone's brakes were melting and everything else. But I loved it. I enjoyed the camaraderie of going back racing. I enjoyed the fact that I was relatively safe, cocooned in a big truck and shouldn't have got hurt. But I'm surprised more people didn't back then, because they didn't even have roll cages in them. Anyway, I did, and I got paid quite nicely to do it by this company called Mitchell Cotts, and I think Mercedes were a bit involved with it, and just thought it was real good fun. And I was dovetailing that, and I did about two races a year back then when I was still racing, still running my team. Just doing the odd British Championship race, but doing really well, I have to say. And after a couple of years, Mercedes-Benz UK got involved and built a proper race truck, because things were moving on quickly, where you had to have roll cages and whatever, and they changed the suspension and whatever, whatever. And it got really quite serious, because the power was coming up a lot, the brakes were much better, and so on and so on. And then carried on doing that. And I think I won a couple of British Championships even whilst I was running my race team.
Right.
But that's what got the eye of Mercedes-Benz Germany in Stuttgart. They realised that I was doing pretty good over here. And I think the boss of Mercedes-Benz Commercial at Milton Keynes, David, anyways, kind of a bit of fan. He loved what I was doing and enjoyed it. He used to come along at the races. And he contacted Mercedes Germany, went out there, and that was it, signed and sealed, and had to let my race team go. Gave it back to another team owner as such, and said thank you to Yamaha, thank you to Loctite, I'm going off and racing. And that's what I did. So from a race rider driver point of view, my career went on a lot longer than most, because it gave me another 10 years of competing.
Yeah, absolutely. So from a racing point of view, how difficult was it to transition from a motorbike, which is very small, you can chuck about, to a truck? That, I mean, you can't just throw a truck about like you can a motorbike, and you've got
Well,
it's.
actually, you, if you think about it, you're a bike rider. There is a similarity, and it works, because a motorcycle, you can say you might be able to chuck it around, but you can't actually really, you can't just throw it into a corner like you can a car, going, you don't just chuck it in. You have to be smooth. You have to kind of turn it in nicely, and if you don't, you fall off. So everything you do on a motorbike has to be done with precision, being smooth. You can't jam the front brake on in a corner like you can in a car. You can't accelerate mid-corner and slide the rear out, or you probably can nowadays. But everything about riding a motorbike is being smooth. And also nice flowing lines. You don't do late apexes with a motorbike so much because it all has to be done. You've got a lot of gyroscopic effect when you're racing a bike, so it's all smooth. And that's exactly what truck racing was about. We had trucks that weighed 5 tons, 5,000 kilos, huge amount of kinetic energy, and a lot of drivers, particularly race car drivers, there was quite a few that made the transition over. They couldn't quite gather that you've got to be smoother and you couldn't throw it around. So everything had to be done very precisely, but very, very smoothly. And I think that helped me. But coming from motorbikes,
Right,
that
okay.
most car drivers that came into truck racing didn't really do that well, actually. No.
Yeah, fair enough. Because I mean, it attracted some pretty big names, and I mean, like Martin Brundle, I think he was also at the first
He
one.
was doing the first race, yeah. Martin Brundle did it. It was Rod Chapman, rally driver. I think Stig Blomqvist had a go at it. Denny Holm. A number of older race drivers had a go at it. Quite a few German race drivers came and had a go at it. Hans Stuck and people like that. And they did okay, but I used to be able to beat them. And that was, quite good, and it worked for me. Latterly, towards the end, I won 5 championships out of 10 years. I have to say, latterly, MAN got better than the Mercedes. I know it's easy to say that, but MAN built a truck that was superior to the Merc, and they got some decent drivers that really kind of worked it out. That, funny enough, one of them was a sidecar racer, and I can't remember his name now.
Okay.
He ended up winning the championship. So, I guess my statistics were pretty good out of the 10 years winning 5 championships. It worked really well.
Yeah, very good.
I think there was something like 7 or 8 British championships. But the best thing was, I only went to hospital once my whole career truck racing. And that was an accident at Donington Park that someone smashed into the side of my truck and the steering wheel got me. I should have been quicker at letting go because you know what it's like if someone hits you. And it broke my scaphoid here. But I'd done it 3 times on bike racing anyway. So I was used to that. So, yeah, again, pretty fortunate. And also, the other string to my bow, I guess you could say, whilst all that was going on, I ended up doing commentary work as well, dovetailing, working on British Championship for ITV, I think it was back then, and then bits and pieces for BBC. I do the British Grand Prix and so on and so on. And literally, as truck racing for me finished, and the reason it finished was 2001, Mercedes withdrew from it. They decided to quit. Which actually knocked the hell out of truck racing. It's sort of great getting yourself back a bit now, but when Mercedes stopped, I think DAF stopped and MAN pulled back and a lot of the teams. It was a bit like Ferrari stopping Formula One. Mercedes were spearheading it. And I ended up that year signing for BBC to cover MotoGP and did 12 years of travelling around doing that.
Yeah.
I'm still celebrating 51 years without having a proper job.
That's pretty impressive going, I would say. And
I'm about to get one now.
yeah, I shouldn't worry. That's not a lot of fun. That's not what's cracked up to be.
No.
But I mean, for me personally, like the late 80s into the 90s was just sort of this golden era of racing. Because also, I was a big fan of the British touring cars. And Murray Walker, just an iconic commentator. Just and one story. I was sat there once watching it on grandstand with Des Lynham, as everybody did. And John Cleland was carved up by somebody. I cannot remember who it was. And naturally, John was a quite sort of chap. Stuck his middle finger up with the in-car camera running, and Murray Walker, just quick as a flash, he's like, "I'm going for first," says John Clennon. And I just remember, as this like young teenager, thinking that was one of the funniest things I'd ever seen.
Well, he was. I actually worked with Murray on 3 occasions covering the British Grand Prix. I used to get drafted in to be his sort of co-commentator or pundit, I guess you could say, and I worked alongside him and got to know Murray very well. He was a lovely man.
Yeah.
But it was with Barry Sheen when he was racing with Kenny Roberts and gave him the V sign, put his hand up and gave him the V, and Murray goes, and he's waving at him. Now he's waving. But yeah, he was probably the master of commentating, and yeah, the Murrayisms, he'd make loads of mistakes, but they were always very funny, and no one really cared, did they? Murray got it a bit wrong. Yeah.
I think it made it a bit more personal, where because it just showed that people are fallible, and and he's getting it wrong live on telly, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, that was and again, I had a wonderful time traveling the world, commentating on MotoGP, which was my first sport, of course. And so yeah, I was very lucky. Covered the TT for about 10 years, covering all that. Still working. In fact, I'll be out in Ireland covering the Northwest 200 in May for BBC Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
I'll be at the TT doing hospitality work. I'm at all the Goodwood events this year, and lots of other hosting of opening of shops and things like that. So I'm still trundling along.
Excellent. Is there any sort of motorsport that you wish you'd had a go at that you never did get a chance?
I nearly, and I say nearly, the sponsorship fell through. I was going to do the Paris-Dakar in a truck
Wow.
with Mercedes backing it, and then something went wrong and it didn't happen. But it was something very much on the cards to do. I wouldn't have minded that. That would have been quite an interesting thing to have done because I know how grueling it is. The boys on the bikes are bloody superheroes because you never know what you're going to come across. But I think it'd have been a bit safer in a truck. But anyway, that didn't happen. So I would have liked to have done that. But other than that, I also spent time whilst commentating for BBC on bikes. I covered the Red Bull Air races, used to do the commentary for that as well, because I got into flying in the early 90s, bought an aeroplane, and I've had about five, six, seven now. And I live on a farm, and we've got an airstrip, and my plane's parked outside the door.
Perfect.
That works as well.
Yeah,
And you.
ideal for commuting.
Yeah, I used to use it a lot whilst working for BBC. We'd go to all the Northern Europe races, France, Belgium, Holland, Germany, all that area. We would use my little plane for it.
Brilliant. Yeah, it's an. I've got a friend of mine who's got shares in a little plane, and he took me up last year, a year before, and it's just so different to being in, like, a commercial sort of jumbo jet. It's just phenomenal, and it's
Yeah, it's a bit like being
something.
on a bike as composed to being in a truck in some ways, or you just all the elements are around you. But the beauty is I lived in the Isle of Man for about 10 years whilst I was doing my commentary work, and it was literally an hour and 20 minutes to the Isle of Man. And it's like, bloody, it's a day's job if you want to drive up to Liverpool and get on a ferry and do this and do that. And same, I remember we'd do the Le Mans Grand Prix. It was one of my favourites. The race would start at 2, finish at 3. At 3:30, we'd be in my plane. I'd take my co-commentator, Charlie Cox, Susie Perry, who would come with me, Matt Roberts. So we would leave by 3:30. Took about an hour and 20 minutes to get back here, so which made it about 4:30, 5 o'clock. Back an hour, 4 o'clock, I'd have my barbecue lit up at home. So it made life so. And you can't imagine how awkward it is to get home from Le Mans because there's no airport near it. And so, yeah, things like that were great, and that was all part of the fun of doing the job that I do, was being able to scoot around and use my own little plane.
Yeah, and enjoy yourself whilst you're doing it.
Yeah, very much
Yeah,
so.
even better. Was there, or is there, any particular track that you've never actually raced on that you want to? I mean, I'm presuming you've probably done most of them once
The
you want.
majority, but clearly there's more and more tracks being built nowadays, particularly for F1. But I think I've pretty much covered all the iconic ones, racing at Spa in Belgium, Daytona in America.
Nürburgring and various
Yeah,
ones
did
like that.
Nürburgring, did that on a motorbike around the Nordschleife. So I think I've Le Mans, places like all the iconic racetracks I've been to, I think. Never raced at Laguna Seca in America, wouldn't have minded that, but commentated there for many, many years. I have ridden around Indianapolis, the Indy bike track. So, yeah, I don't think there's anything that's bugging me too much that I haven't done. No,
No,
no, no, no.
fair enough. So what does the future hold then? Just a bit more commentating, enjoying yourself, avoiding
Yeah,
getting a proper job.
but I'm never going to get one of them, I don't think. This year I've got 18 shows I do with a guy called Henry Cole. Have you ever come across Henry Cole, who does Find It, Flog It, Shed and Buried,
Yes.
show? And that started last year properly. We did 16 shows last year, all a sellout. We've got 18 to do this year, starting next week. We're in, where, Wolver no, Worcestershire, something like that. I don't know, I can't remember. But I did 10 years of my own theatre show called The Mad Tour,
Yeah.
traveling the country doing that, which was good fun. My daughter hosted it for most of the shows, then my wife did. It was sort of a, I guess, an interrogation of my life, a bit like we're talking about now, which went on for 2 hours, with a break in the middle, of course. So I've got 18 of those to do, some commentary work. I'm at all the Goodwoods. I'm doing Shelsea Wolf Hill Climb. I'm going to Oliver's Mount Scarborough for a couple of events up there, over to Ireland, TT. So, yeah, enough really. I love playing tennis, which I do a couple of times a week, and I play golf a couple of times a week. I'm fortunate enough to have an apartment and a boat in Mallorca, so I go out there quite regularly. Just got back from South Africa, where I was out there with friends and do some classic bike demo stuff out there. So, yeah,
Fantastic.
kind of living the dream, I guess you'd say. But I still moan about the cost of fuel and electric bills, as we all do, because we get up our own arses and are stupid, really, when we should be just enjoying our lives.
Very true. Yeah, very true. Just before we wrap up, I'm just going to rewind a little bit back to the origins of truck racing. So for any younger listener who isn't too aware of the British truck racing scene, when it first started, you would literally have hauliers, because like you said, you had a Mitchell Kotz road truck. It was literally on the road Monday to Friday. They would turn up at the track, drop their trailer, slap some numbers on, go race, finish, pick that trailer back up, and then probably drive it quite gingerly with some extremely knackered brakes, I would say.
Yeah, and tyres, I guess. But you're right. In the early days, I remember a lot of the Italians would come over and the trailers would be parked up in the car park at Donington. And they'd go out and race these things and then hook them back up and go home. They were probably because like everyone did, you cheated on the fueling and opened them up and so on and so on. And I can't even remember if tacos were in back in those days, but everyone was on the fiddle with everything. But literally, they were road vehicles. But ever so quickly, if let's say that was 84 or 5, by the next 2 years, they were. Because in the early days, the funny part was they used to put you in, there were three categories. And I think it was up to 300 horsepower, 400 and 500 or something like that. So they put you in different races. So you, but everyone just changed the badge on the bloody truck. And instead of it being a 440 horsepower, 1644, you'd put on a, a 1633 or badge on it or something. So they couldn't measure them. And that cheated like hell. So then they put rolling roads in. I remember going to Silverstone, which would have been 86, 7. They put rolling roads in and decided they'd check A, the top speed, because they had a restriction on top speed of 100 mile an hour, and B, the horsepower. Well, I know in my truck, if you turn the radio on, which was above you, it gave it another 150 horsepower. So everyone had all sorts of cheating going on. And even to the extent where someone had the gears the other way around, so they never ever put it into its top gear and they measured it 100 mile an hour, but it'd actually do 120 or something like that. There was just lots and lots of cheating going on. But since then, it's got very professional, so much so that everything is electronically checked as far as speeds are concerned. Everything is horsepower. Wise is monitored and revs are monitored and so on and so on. And it's become a very, very professional sport now. But they went when Mercedes stopped in 2001, it went back to more what I call a privateer class. So now they have manual gearboxes. We had paddle shift, six speed sequential paddle. We had traction control and this and that and everything else. The truck I was driving, I think the last one I drove was worth million and a half pounds. It had 2,200 horsepower and 8,000 newton meters of torque, or something stupid like that. It was a proper monster. We did some television shows where they've got 911 turbo Porsches out and things like that, and my truck would blast one of them 100 miles an hour.
I'm not surprised that sort of horsepower and torque. It's just absolutely phenomenal. I suppose, although it was cheating, it was being quite innovative in how to tune up a vehicle and things like that. And it opened up what the truck racing could become, sort of thing.
Well, most importantly, I'd have said that there's no question about it. Mercedes-Benz used it for development, engine reliabilities, stresses, and so on and so on. I mean, when you think we used the 12-litre V6 engine that had 2,000 horsepower, well, on the road, I guess it's got 500, 600. I don't know what it is. I don't know. Probably that's about the horsepower that that engine would have. But most importantly, Mercedes spent loads of money developing particular filters and keeping the smoke down and everything else. So a lot of the stuff that's now used on the roads to stop the emissions and things like that got developed. There's certainly the disc brakes all got developed. I think they used a water-cooled system in the Alps for some of the trucks and things like that. So we had water-cooled brakes. A number of the things that got developed in truck racing overstressed everything so they could make it better for road vehicles. And it really was a moving development package.
Well, yeah, it makes sense. Just give it a try on a track with a race driver. Giving it hell, sort of thing. Yeah, makes perfect sense.
No, there's an awful lot of technology was transferred back into the road vehicles. Now, and I recently did a job for, oh, it was in COVID, so it's what, 3 or 4 years ago, for Iveco, the launch of their new
Yes, way.
S way. And I did the launch of it for them, and we ended up going to Millbrook and doing some stuff. What a lovely machine to drive. I know they're all like it now, but I mean, it's just beautiful to be in. It's a pleasure to be driving it.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you have to do a HGV test to be able to race them, or was your tip
No,
of your race
you
license?
didn't. It wasn't obligatory to do it, but BP, that sponsored me just about all my career of truck racing, thought it'd be good publicity for me to do my HGV, which I did.
Okay.
I went to, they sent me off to, I think it was Welsh's or somewhere like that, to do driver training, which normally is a week or more. I don't know. I did it anyway. In 3 days, I'd done it. I knew how to back the trailer and all the stuff that I used to do on the farm and things like that. So that wasn't a problem. And I went around Cambridge for 2 or 3 days. And then I went to Water Beach near Cambridge to do my test. And Anglia Television turned up, BBC East turned up, and whatever, whatever. And I probably went and failed.
I was going to say, no pressure with all the TV crews turning
No.
up.
And I knew I was going to fail because at the time, the bloke that was instructing or was taking my test was such a miserable, bloody, no humour. And he looked, I pulled up in my Mercedes car, I guess, because I was sponsored by Mercedes, with a number plate Pen 15, which looks a bit like penis. And he said, "Whose is that disgusting car?" And whatever, whatever, whatever. So that was me done for. Anyway, you were back then. I don't think it still happened. I think I went back 2 days later because you could just retest and pass my test. So I had an HGV class one, and had it all the way through to the point where you have to do lots of tests to keep it up. So I haven't.
Fair
Anyway,
enough, yeah.
never got to drive a proper, I mean, apart from doing my test and my driving tuition, I never got to drive a road truck on the road ever.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah. Some would probably say you're quite lucky for that. I was going to ask you about that number plate because I do remember vaguely reading about it somewhere. Were you told to remove it from the car in the end, or was it?
I got banned in the Isle of Man. When I moved out to the Isle of Man, they didn't like it, so I ended up selling that number. It must be 20 years ago now, 15, 20 years ago. But I bought 60CK, and that looks a bit like, I use that now.
Well, why not? You got to have a sense of humour, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, makes me smile.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so Pen 15 is still out there somewhere then,
Somewhere's
presumably.
got it. I think it was last seen. I sold it for quite a lot of money. It was on Reg Transfers, a company that buys and sells number plates for £100,000.
Wow.
So whether anyone's bought it, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But I bought it quite reasonable and sold it for a lot of money.
Fair enough, yeah. What wise man, yeah, absolutely. So just before we say goodbye, I just want to mention a good friend of mine, Dominic Newby, who has been very good to me when I've started this podcast, and I know he's a big fan of yours. So, well, as I'm interviewing you, I just thought I'd just say hello and thank you to Dominic whilst chatting to you. Thank you for your support and all your help.
Hey Dominic, well done for supporting things, and maybe see you at one of the events somewhere along the line. Do you know, I still follow the truck racing a little bit, but I never get to go back. I did get invited, I think, to Nürburgring some years back, but I don't know. I think it was COVID or something like that. But it's really weird how your whole life is wrapped around a sport, and then all of a sudden you leave, and it's like phew, gone. I'm still involved with motorcycling, of course, because that was my first love. But truck racing now, I don't really know anyone in it now. I guess it's Ryan Smith, I think he's the guy that's winning everything at the moment. I've done a couple of things with him, and I am going in 2 weeks' time for the first truck race at Brands Hatch.
Oh, wonderful.
And the reason I'm going, it's a bit of a gathering of old geezers like me, truck racers, because I think Brands Hatch is celebrating something like 100 years of it being open, and I've been invited along into a box to go and watch. So I'll be going along to the first race this year. And it must be 4 or 5 years since I've been to one, so I'm
Yeah.
enjoying forward to having a look at what's going on.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant.
I see now, if most of the people that race in trucks now are sons of the people that I used to race against.
Yes. Yep. So, I mean, it's great that it's still going and going strong and seems to be getting more and more sort of momentum behind it, which is fantastic.
It's just not on TV as much as it used to be. That's the problem now. I don't know where it is or if it is, but it was. It was bloody huge on Eurosport back when I was doing it in the 90s. I guess the reason it was on so much is the manufacturers used to kind of give the footage away, and it was always on every bloody day on Eurosport and things like that,
Yeah.
which a lot of people still say to me, is the truck racing still going? Well, I guess the reason they don't know it is because they don't get to see it very much now.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps it's just because we've got so many channels now. Like,
Sure.
say, if it's on there, it's probably on there somewhere. But I mean, I wouldn't know where to begin to look for it because I don't really watch TV, to be fair. So,
No. Me either. Yeah,
but there we
good.
go. Right, well, Steve, I've taken up more than enough of your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. I've really enjoyed this.
What truck do you drive then?
I'm currently driving a Renault T Range, or two of them. I've got my own company, but I'm just a driver as such. So I flit about. I also drive quite often a DAF XG, a few different Volvos, things like that. So,
Okay. And what
but
are you hauling? What do you haul?
I haul sawdust and wood shavings mostly, so it's all just local stuff. Get a lot of time at
Yeah.
home. So not currently doing nights out and whatnot. Just enjoying myself and having a social life for a change after 20 odd years up the road, however long it was.
Okay. All right. Good. Well, drive safely. You've got to nowadays, though. You can't be seen not, that's for sure. You've got so many restrictions. And you have to stop for so many hours, don't you? And whatever,
Absolutely.
whatever. The whole world's changed dramatically, hasn't it?
Oh, 100%. It's not getting easier on the roads either, sadly.
No, I'm sure not. Good talking to you, and well done to Dominic for supporting you, and maybe catch up with you sometime.
Yes, we'll hopefully touch base again soon, Steve.
All right, take
Lovely.
care.
Thanks a lot. Cheers. Ta-da.